Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of 342 Productions. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Dunker Nation, let's ride. Nikias, let's hoop it up. You ready to say words?
Yes, I am ready to say words. I'm going to do my best to say words and do so coherently. A lot of playoff hoops since the last time we talked. As I was preparing the show sheet for this one, I realized, oh, right, on Thursday, we did record in the morning. We recorded before game two of Lakers Warriors. So we got three games of thoughts and notes and takes to get to on that one. That's fun. We also have a little bit of news to kick off the pod with. That's going to be fun. We got some award announcements. We had a coaching firing, which isn't fun. We can start with Mike Budenholzer being let go by the Milwaukee Bucks after that 4-1 series victory for the Miami Heat. Steve, were you surprised at all that this move was made?
Of the timing a little, but I think maybe they had felt that they had reached as far as they could with this group, especially when you have this kind of season. After a disappointing season, you win 58 games, the defense is on point all season long, you're the one seed, you climbed up there, and then it all falls apart in the first round to the Miami Heat. And if there's one team that you probably couldn't lose to in that fashion, it was the Miami Heat. So I just think it was more of a where else can we go with this type of decision? What more is left? Obviously, unfortunate timing with everything Coach Bud's going through. But I don't know if they felt the buy-in was still there with the window that they have. As far as having Giannis in the specific window for this team, if they're going to decide to keep it together, if they're going to try and move and evolve a little bit, there's only so much time you have left with these guys. So I don't think they felt that there was more left on the table.
I got you. Because we briefly touched on, hey, what happens with Bud after the series? Once we did the, hey, where does Milwaukee go from here? A couple of pods ago. And I remained a little bit surprised that they made this move. I figured that there was enough context between the Giannis injury and, you know, as we later found out, what Bud's going through on a personal level. I figured that would be enough to where next season becomes the, hey, we might have to bring these guys back. But Lopez is an unrestricted free agent. We don't have a whole bunch of picks to maneuver. We're probably going to bring this team back, but this is the last go at it. It's kind of how I figured they would play that. So making the move caught me a little bit off guard, but as you said, like the reasoning behind that does make some sense. And I am just curious to see where they pivot, not only with the roster, but just, I mean, with the coaching decision in general. We've seen Nick Nurse's name floated out there. Charles Lee is on staff. He seems to be highly regarded. I just wonder where they go and what this Bucks team is going to look like in terms of the roster. And even conceptually, new head coach is going to be in there. What tweaks are going to be made? What are they going to prioritize trying to change from a scheme perspective? So I guess we shall see. Oh, did you have a final thought? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good. I mean, I think it's fair. I think this Milwaukee team navigated between really great offense and really great defense over the course of this time. And unfortunately, you got the one ring out of it, but you didn't get the success you really needed. So I want to see where they pivot to next, what moves they make. I think the roster moves are just as important as the coaching move. See how they want to build on this, but yeah, we'll stay tuned.
Stay tuned indeed. One award that we want to talk through very briefly before getting into these playoff series. The all-rookie teams were announced. Jalen Williams, Benedict Mathurin, Keegan Murray, Paolo Banchero, your rookie of the year, Walker Kessler on the first team, Jaden Ivey, Tari Eason, Jabari Smith Jr., Jeremy Sochan, Jalen Duren as your second team. How'd you feel about the teams? Any surprises? Any thoughts beyond them?
Oh, this is your rant zone. I thought we were going to get a full Nikias rant here. The only surprise to me was Tari Eason over Andrew Nembhard. I thought Andrew Nembhard was really, really good for Indiana this year. Mm-hmm. That's no disrespect to Tari Eason. I thought he played his role well. I thought he grew a lot of energy, a lot of defense. I just thought Nembhard was really good for them. But outside of that, no real surprises. I guess maybe you could tap on Jaden Ivey not being on the first team. But I think with the names listed on the first team, you kind of felt those were the five. So not too shocked. What say you?
I don't have a rant for any of this, because as we talked through like our final award picks a little bit earlier, like the 10 names listed were part of like my final 11 or 12. So like I didn't see find anything egregious or anything like that. It was funny looking at some of the results. Like apparently there was someone that had both Jalen Williams's from OKC on their first team, which cool. I respect the nod to defense and contributing to a play-in team. So cool. I guess the Tari Eason thing surprises me in the sense that he got two first place votes. And I just wonder, okay, what would the rest of the ballots, what would the rest of that ballot look like? Or those two ballots look like if Tari Eason was first team for you? Like my mind immediately goes to you really prioritize defense, which I don't think is a bad thing. I think you kind of expect rookie defense to be bad. So I'm cool with celebrating rookies that do provide positive impact on the defensive end. But with Tari Eason receiving those two first place votes, he ends out beating Andrew Nembhard out for the last spot on the second team by literally 1 point. I think the first place votes are worth 2 points each. And so if he literally does not get, if he gets one first place vote, Andrew Nembhard makes his team. I think if there's a surprise beyond the first place votes for Tari Eason, I think Jeremy Sochan, who ended up being like a last cut for me, just in terms of games played. So him making it was a little bit of a surprise, but like he was really solid for San Antonio. And I think the versatility really popped. I can understand it popping for other voters. So I don't even think that's a bad pick. That was just something that I didn't have. But beyond that, solid work. Like I don't have any major complaints. Now I will say we're recording on a Tuesday morning. We are getting all defense teams and all NBA teams over the next 2 days. I may have a different tune when we record the second pod this week. But for right now, I don't have qualms. I'm good.
This is a massive upset. I was looking for Christian Brown disrespect. What's up with Jaden Hardy? Mark Williams. I thought you'd go with a Charlotte rant here. How could three people leave Keegan Murray off a ballot? I thought we had some things here, but it's okay. This is growth.
Well, you know, as you bring those things up, I don't understand how Keegan doesn't end up on three ballots. That's not great. It's not quite the Jokic rant, how you leave him off the ballot, but Keegan played well. You can't do that. Second place vote for Mark Williams. I mean, he just entered the rotation really like second half of the year. I don't know about that one. Now you're getting it, Chuck. Still, I think the teams themselves ended up well. So I will just leave it there. Let's talk about some playoff hoops. We got four series to get into. We got two that may be on the verge of ending very soon. But at any rate, the games tonight, as we record early on this Tuesday morning, we have the Sixers and the Celtics, and we also have the Suns and the Nuggets. So we're going to start with those two series first. We'll start in the East. We're tied at 2-2. The Celtics with a 114-102 victory in game three. Big Jason Tatum game, big Jaylen Brown game, big Al Horford game. He bounced back from game two. And then in game four, the Sixers with an overtime win, 116-115, a James Harden masterclass. Joel Embiid all over the place defensively in that one. Boston, the final two possessions that include Jaylen Brown helping from the strong side corner off of James Harden, and then Jason Tatum and just Boston in general taking their sweet time on the final possession, and Joe Mazzulla watching the Celtics take their sweet time with two timeouts in the back pocket. As someone that is very, very, very keen on what is the process looking like? Are we doing the right things here? I didn't understand either one of those possessions. But at any rate, tied series, 2-2. And I think what's popped for me so far through four games, or particularly the last two games, so much of this feels dictated by how comfortable James Harden is inside the arc. Can he get to his spots? Is he comfortable getting to his spots? And can he flow into shots from there? Can he get to the drive? Can he get to the pull-up? Can he get to the step-back midi? What does that comfort look like? And I think for Boston, a lot of their defensive infrastructure and the way that they have peeled in their help, very aggressive help, it's been to take James Harden out of his comfort zone, knowing that he's likely leading the dance in pick and roll. Let's funnel him to his right hand. Let's funnel him to help. Whoever's defending him has largely been Jaylen Brown since game two. We're not only are we going to shade you to that right hand, we're going to play that top shoulder to a point where we are also trying to take away this pocket pass for you. We're going to get a hand in the lane. And with the help peeled in, we're also going to make sure, even if you slip it by Jaylen Brown's arm, we are meeting Joel Embiid on the catch. And there were some adjustments in game four with how Philadelphia dealt with that. I'll leave that to you because I know that was something that popped for you. But it's mostly, can James Harden get to his spots? Can Boston keep him uncomfortable? And I think going back to the game three, where James Harden had, I think, 16 points, it was a quiet outing. you could feel the pockets where he wasn't as aggressive. And that became like a point on the broadcast. I saw it on my personal timeline. Like, why is he passing up shots? I think a lot of that was just Boston doing a really good job of locking into the game plan. Like, if you are going to win this possession, you can only take this shot or these couple of shots. You can only go to this direction. This skip pass to PJ Tucker is the only thing that we are personally allowing based on how we're helping. And you're going to have to make that skip pass with your offhand. Like, I think it was very detailed game planning from Boston to execute it. But then you zoom. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. No, keep going. Keep going.
No, last thing I was going to say, just to the Harden comfort point. In the two Sixer wins in this series, James Harden, one, he's averaging over 40 points, which is just hilarious. But he's 20 of 30 on shots inside the arc. In the two losses, James Harden is 3 of 15 inside the arc. Now, we're dealing with a four-game sample and two games apiece with the wins and the losses. So the percentage is going to swing. But, like, that feels about right. When he's been able to look good inside the arc and get to those shots and kind of manipulate things from there, he looks good. The Philadelphia offense hums. When he can't and he doesn't, it doesn't. And I'll pass this on to you.
Well, I hate to simplify it too much, but it is a make or miss league. And in the nights that we've seen James Harden have the big games, he's been taking and making those shots. Games 2 and 3, I'm glad you mentioned Boston defense. It feels like just like a little in between where James is trying to figure out that balance between, do I make them pay for this help or do I take these shots? And we've seen when he's decisive, it looks different. Now, obviously, being able to hit the mid-range step back helps. Being able to take and make those threes helps get him in a rhythm, get him in a flow. But finding that balance is important for him. He's got to understand this is a series he has to stay aggressive at all times.
Mm-hmm.
If Boston is going to be as locked in, and we've seen the game plan. We're going to pressure the ball. We're going to try and force it right if we can. We're going to drop. We're going to pull and take everything away. We're going to try and take that pocket pass away from you. Philadelphia did a really good job of trying to flip the angle of the screen in game 4 to get James Harden going back left. If it was a scenario where he was going to his right, they tried to put Tyrese Maxey one pass away. So they tried to do little things spacing-wise to either open some things up or at least make Boston think for a second. I think that it's important for Philadelphia to get that spacing right. I think there are gaps for Tyrese Maxey to attack. But when it comes to James, he's got to just find the rhythm, find the balance, and understand when to take those shots. Now, it's going to be interesting because Boston started to just outright switch a lot more as that game developed. And so is that going to be the thing where Boston's like, okay, you have to deal with this. You have to deal with these matchups. We're still going to show help, but we're going to switch. Or does that open Joel Embiid up? Because when you look at the balance of this series, it kind of feels like, can the Sixers open up enough for James Harden and Joel Embiid? And can Boston get the stops they need to get out in transition and move the ball offense?
Mm-hmm. And that's been the fun part of the chess match here, because you talked about like just the individual adjustments. Again, Marcus Smart got the James Harden assignment in game 1. It's largely been Jaylen Brown since then. I think Jaylen Brown, across those 2-3 games, like he's done a solid job overall. Malcolm Brogdon's had good reps against James Harden. But like beyond that, it's just been fun to watch Boston kind of navigate things. They're also playing with the matchups, not just with James Harden, but okay, cool. Al Horford, you have Joel Embiid this trip. Okay, now Marcus Smart, you have Joel Embiid this trip. Okay, Jason Tatum, now you have him. And then whoever is on PJ Tucker, you just get DeRome, you can peel some guys out, et cetera, et cetera. So like they're throwing a lot of different things at Philadelphia. I do wonder, as you mentioned, like how Philadelphia has been trying to open up the Harden Embiid two-man game. If it does become switching, how quickly can they get into it? I think the tempo is going to be a very important thing for Philadelphia as well. Because I think what's been important about the ball pressure gambit in particular for Boston is that, like, no, you're not going to force James Harden to throw a turnover at half court or anything like that, especially with the amount of step-up screens that they're calling for near half court. But if you can take 6 or 7 seconds to get across, and now your help is loaded up even more, you try to get that Harden and Embiid two-man game going. If you navigate the catch well, or if you take away the pocket pass immediately, it's either just going to be one relatively bad shot, and then you get the board and you push, or it doesn't work. We swinging around. All right, Tyrese Maxey has the ball. They're 7 on the shot clock now. Have fun against this set defense.
No, I think the tempo is very important, and not just in pick and roll, but just overall. I thought between game 3 and game 4, Philadelphia did a better job of making quicker decisions, but that game 3 was, hey, whatever you're trying to do, we're going to make you do it in about 8 more seconds than you want to. You want to try and get to Joel Embiid at the elbow? Well, we're denying. And there's someone helping behind. So now we've taken 5 or 6 seconds off. You have less time to work with. You want to get to a pick and roll? We're pressuring up the court. Now you're trying to explore. Time's going off the clock. When Philadelphia is able to initiate their sets early and then keep the ball moving, those are their best possessions. Boston's defense, they're flipping matchups. They're showing help. They're feeling comfortable. But again, they're showing help. So you have pressure points. You have pieces where you can get to their defense. Can you get to drive and kick? Can Maxey find those gaps? Can Tobias find those gaps? Can PJ Tucker mix in the shots and the swing and the ball? That's where I feel like the balance is.
Just on the Harden and Embiid front very quickly, in terms of the picks between those two, only 13 in game two, that was Embiid's first game back, 20 in game three, 34 in game four. So we're really starting to see that volume pick up between those two. As you mentioned, the spacing tweaks that Philadelphia made to kind of open that up a little bit more. Tempo is going to be very important. I have a Philadelphia question for you before I flip to my Boston thoughts, because we talked about, you know, we touched on tempo and process, and boy, do I have some questions with what Boston's been doing. But how have you felt about the PJ Tucker minutes so far?
I felt fine with it. I think they need his defensive activity more than a lot of people want to give him credit for. If they're going to be rotating, being as active and have the ability to throw switches at Boston, he's a key part of it because he can defend multiple positions. You would love for more shots to go down, but I think when he gets the kick, he's doing a good job swinging the ball. So I would put him in the doing his job category. Where are you at with it?
I'm in a odd place. You said you need him to make those shots. I need him to take those shots from the corner. I think that's going to be a big thing. But I mostly wonder about him in relation to, one, how well DeAnthony Melton is playing. Two, how surprisingly well George Niang has held up defensively throughout the series so far, and what his spacing means for the offense as well. And just in general, PJ Tucker's presence offensively has allowed Boston to play with the matchups the way that they can go smart on Joel Embiid to bother him 35 feet from the basket. Because we know if we do end up with a post up or something on this side, we can just get Al Horford over here, or we can just really peel in the help beyond that. And so I just wonder, like, how Philadelphia can move him around and just kind of stress Boston out a little bit more. And for PJ in particular, like, hey, if you get swings, you got to shoot immediately. And I remember going through, you know, some of the clips either live or when we did the Harden breakdown in game one, it's like sometimes PJ's spaced, they make a swing, he's standing right beside the guy that's spaced. And it's like, well, brother, you're good at navigating space and moving off ball. Like, some of you can't afford these laps with the way Boston's guarding you as well. So let's just keep my eye on that. And then you look at like Jalen McDaniels. I don't think he played in game four in large part because Boston has basically matched the Jalen McDaniels minutes with Robert Williams. It's like, okay, we're just going to put you on Jalen and we're just going to ignore him completely. And so obviously Philly and Doc, they're feeling at least some of the spacing stuff. And that bled into no Jalen, a lot more George Niang. Again, we've seen the minute load for DeAnthony Melton perk up because of the way that he can knock down shots and just his defensive impact as well. Like, he's been all over the place. He's pounded multiple players in the series. He deserves the hat too. So that's why I'm just trying to gauge like where you were with PJ. But I think if he's not knocking down shots, or Philly just can't find spots for him to move Boston's defense, or so they just can't load up the way that they have, it gets a little iffy with his minutes.
I think it's more just also his size as well. I think that Melton has held up and done his job, but I still think Jason Tatum likes that matchup to a degree. And I don't know how much you want to hand Boston those kind of things that they enjoy. So I'm keeping an eye on that. I think it's how have you felt about Joel Embiid over these last two games?
I have been, you know, we talked about it after his debut, like, surprised with the defense and how well he's looked overall there. Like, the rim protection has really been strong for him. Defense very good. Offense, like, still feels like he's trying to find his way. I think what bothered me the most in game four, and I think a lot of this is just a testament to how well Al Horford played him, but like, he would get a catch around the free throw line or get a catch on the wing or something. And it's a catch and a hold and a survey. And it's just like, brother, Boston wants to load up their help. They want to build a wall. Like, they want to pinch in from this corner. They want to have a guy at the nail. They want to bother you. If you get a catch where one side of the help isn't keyed in, you got to go. Either catch, turn, shoot, catch, turn, pump and drive, immediate post up, then force the help and then play out of that. That's where it kind of bothered me in the game four. And again, like Al Horford in particular did a really good job of, particularly in the second half. So I do want to give him his credit. But some of this is on Joel to, you have to move, with you got to move some attention. You got to go, because Boston is loading up in a way to make your life difficult. Don't hand that to them if you can help it.
I think Embiid had his bouts of making quick decisions. I think he also is trying to survey and get a feel for what Boston's throwing at him, because again, it might be a wing or a guard trying to deny him. It might be Al Horford roaming from the weak side. It might be a double on his once he starts his post move. So just throwing little things at him rhythm-wise. I think it's very ironic, though. The Sixers did all this work to shift Joel Embiid's touches from the post to the elbow. And Boston said, nope, we're not letting you catch it there. We're going to deny and make that really hard. And so Philadelphia was like, well, Joel Embiid, go back to the post. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. So again, for me, I think if Boston can make it hard on Embiid and Harden, that's where they win the series. Game three, they just made it tough. They tried to wear on them. I think Boston has to try and get back to that. But again, it's a three-game series now. So you get one more Harden game, you get one Joel Embiid game. What happens?
We're talking about Philly in the Eastern Conference Finals if that happens. if that's what can go. On the Boston side, very quickly, they are so good. They are so good on both ends of the floor. And I've largely liked their defense in the series. But offensively, they can do so many things. This has been the most consistently aggressive driving series I've seen from Jason Tatum in quite a while. Jaylen Brown has been landing first quarter, first half punches with some of his drives in the early pull-ups. And they just have spacing everywhere. They can flow side to side. They can use their bigs as help. Boston can do so many good things on offense. But then there are the patches of games, like the entire first half of game four, where Boston is either just in the mud. And I do want to give the hat tip to Philadelphia's general activity defensively, their ball pressure. It's not just Boston beating themselves. I don't want to make that point. But like, Boston will walk the ball up the floor, one swing pull up. Boston will walk the ball up the floor, hold it. First screen coming is with 13 on the shot clock. It doesn't work. It swings. A second screen comes. There's 5 on the shot clock. Please save us, Jaylen or Jason. We've seen the formula of this offense. We have seen what it looks like when Marcus Smart gets downhill, shifts the defense, makes the kick. They're playing against a tilted defense. We've seen Al Horford in the middle of the floor. Derek White screening for Jason Tatum on one side, Marcus Smart screening for Jaylen Brown on the other side. You pick which way you want to go. It's an empty corner look. They flow out of that. We've seen what that looks like. These pockets of time for Boston where they just lose it and either go in way too slow offensively and put their backs against the wall, or it's a quick Marcus Smart three with 17 on the clock. Why are you feeding Philadelphia transition opportunity or early offense opportunity when your entire defense is predicated on, we are loading up help, we are sending James Harden a specific way, we are trying to push these Joel Embiid touches elsewhere, we need the help locked in to do that. We want to do fancy cross-matching things after timeouts. All of this is based on being set. You can't be set if your offensive process is bad. Boston can't keep getting in their own way like this.
Ah, I see. Well, it's funny. Game three, game four, two different stories. Game three, I thought they were really moving the ball. When the tempo's up, when the ball movement's up, when they're playing random, when they have the dribble penetration, that's when they are their most dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I think they have to maintain that tempo. They're going to have to make the Sixers continue to work defensively. They're going to have to test those closeouts. They're going to have to force them in rotation. Sixers' activity was a lot better in game four, but Boston has to say, okay, keep doing that. Can we get you from anticipating to reacting? And when Boston got them reacting, good things usually happen for them. Jason Tatum's been aggressive getting downhill. Jaylen Brown's been aggressive getting downhill. They can open things up that way. But you can't bog yourself down. You can't see switches and slow down. They have to keep the pressure up. And so if Philadelphia, as the series has gone on, you've seen more switches, even with Embiid in the lineup, is that their counter to say, okay, Boston, go ahead and slow it down a little bit. Let's see if now we can load up, we can close out, we can make sure we get everything in front.
Yeah. And I think that's just, I guess that's the most frustrating part of watching Boston, because based on who they have personnel-wise and the way they generally space the floor, like, they can consistently get Philadelphia in rotation more so than the inverse. And as you pointed to in game three, it was largely, we will get you guys moving. We will get you shifting. It helped that Philadelphia couldn't knock down shots in game three and they were able to push a little bit more off of those misses. But even in the half court, like, it's just, they had it. They felt like they largely had it. And in game four, the first half of game four, they did not. And like, it's just what, like, it's basketball. Sometimes you will generate good shots and miss them. We've seen that. I would much rather be talking about, man, I felt good about what Boston did, but they couldn't knock down enough shots, or, you know, tip the cap to Philadelphia shot making. And you go from there. I hate watching the Boston games where it feels like they just lose the plot. And that's what a lot of that's a lot of what game four felt like. And with this Philly team getting some confidence, like, you can't, it's a best of three now. You can't afford to lose the plot. Like, it, to your earlier point, it's a make or miss lead. I hope that's the commentary versus what is Boston doing? What are they trying to get to? Where is the tempo? Where is the purpose?
So, Nikias, whose process do you trust more?
Oh, goodness. I guess the answer is meh. No, but I guess in all seriousness, it's weird. Like, I probably trust Philly's process a little bit more offensively, but I trust Boston's talent more. And so Boston actually, you know, if they consistently tap into the process portion of it, like, Boston should be able to generate enough good shots to have an advantage moving forward. But Boston has to do it. Philly's going to do their best to take it away. And as you alluded to, like, much better pressure in general defensively for Philadelphia in game four. And they did so, again, without Jalen McDaniels logging minutes in that. They still were able to find it collectively. So it's a genuine hat tip to what Philadelphia's able to do. But also, Boston just has to work past that. Like, we've seen the formula. We've seen the blueprint with them. This year, we saw it, you know, when they made the big run second half of last season. We know they can do it. Do the right things. Play the right way. That's all you got to do. Any closing thoughts on Philly-Boston before we move?
No, I mean, I think both sides have shown their path to victory. I'm very interested to see how it goes going forward. Who steps up? Does Tyrese Maxey have a big game? I think there are gaps for him to attack, especially if Boston's not going to be as locked in on him. So keep an eye on that. But if Boston's able to work defensively, get out in transition, and move the ball offensively, it's going to be tough for Philly.
It's going to be tough indeed. Let's move to the second game for Tuesday night slate. The Denver Nuggets and the Phoenix Suns. We are now tied at two games apiece. Both teams handled their business at home. A 121-114 win in game three for Phoenix. A 129-124 win in game four for Phoenix. Devin Booker is insane. Before even getting into any of the scheme tweaks, I do have some notes on that, what Phoenix did differently offensively. Devin Booker has drained nearly 66% of his two-point shots in this series. He is shooting 57% from three in this series. He has gotten busy in transition. He has gotten busy in isolation to the point to where even when he's isolated on the left side of the floor and Kevin Durant's one pass away, they still send double teams to him. Because, like, no, we are not letting you cook. We've seen the occasional post bucket. We've seen the drives. We've seen contested pull-ups. Devin Booker's doing whatever he wants as a scorer. And the playmaking has really popped over the last two games. And this kind of takes me to my big picture thing. Like, on Twitter, I did a breakdown on Phoenix running double drag more in game four. That was cool. But, like, I think overall, they've done such a good job of stringing out Denver's defense when they put two to the ball.
Ah, you don't say.
Yeah, I do. No, I'm just kidding. But if only, you know,
is this thing on? Don't worry about it.
Nah, I see what's going on here. I see. But no, I think he's done a very good job of stringing things out when Denver puts two to the ball. He is putting stress on Jokic when he's at the level, bringing things out. That's putting more strain on the back end. And from there, he's just making the right pass. It's a feed to DeAndre Ayton. It's a skip to Terrence Ross. It's a skip to Kevin Durant. He gets to attack the scrambling defense as they try to rotate and get back in there. It's just been really masterful stuff from Devin Booker as a ball handler, period. And naturally, a lot more of that responsibility has shifted to him with Chris Paul being out the last two games. The role players have stepped up in the absence. Campaign, pushing the ball in transition. They're just playing a lot faster in this one in terms of transition frequency. In game two, Chris Paul's last game, Phoenix was in transition on roughly 9% of their possessions. Game three, 14.9%. Game four, 14%. They're just getting after it a little bit more. They're getting faster. That's, again, unlocking Devin Booker in transition. That's unlocking the drives for Kevin Durant, which that's really popped over the last two games. Really the last 2.5 games. I think second half of game two, he just didn't have anything going with the jumper. He just put his head down a lot and was like, huh, that's interesting. Didn't matter for the result in game two, but that's going to matter moving forward. They have to be able to generate rim pressure. They have to be able to get to the free throw line and get them some easy ones. Kevin Durant's been getting downhill, and the jumper's starting to come back. It's been a lot of burden on those two Phoenix stars, but they've largely nailed it. And I really like the way that Devin Booker's been used. I like what he's done against Denver's coverage, which kind of brings me back to, I guess, the general Denver question that we've talked through this season of the pod. How much scheme versatility does Denver have? Because with Chris Paul out, the drop has largely gone away over these last two games. How much switching have we seen from Denver over the last two? Not a ton. It's largely been Jokic, you are at the level. And with Devin Booker stringing things out the way that he has, it's just really put Denver's defense to the limit. You can talk about the shot making, but like conceptually, they're doing a better job of getting good looks consistently in the half court.
This is the big question I had. Huh. With coming into the series, I wanted to see what is Denver going to do defensively? How are they going to handle two on the ball? The scheme versatility was, hey, Chris Paul, when you do stuff, we're going to be in a drop. Without Chris Paul, can Phoenix find enough with Devin Booker, with Kevin Durant, who are going to be pressure points because they're not going to switch Jokic on them as of right now? I don't think they really want to in general, but that's going to draw two on the ball. It's just about Denver's defense for me. Kevin Durant and Devin Booker with this level of shot making is absolutely insane. That's tough enough to deal with. Was it 86 points in game three, combined 72 points in game four? What, Devin Booker's missed 9 shots in his last two games? 34-43, 9 shots? It's not just the scoring, though. It's now Phoenix hitting the right notes and opening things up playbook-wise. And I know this is something you want to touch on, but if Devin Booker and Kevin Durant are consistently get two on the ball, Denver can't afford to give all of this up. You can't give up the star play shot making. You can't give up the drives on the closeouts. You can't give up the rolls because they're scheming things open. When they can ding you with a little bit of everything, it's tough. Like once Phoenix started to see, okay, not only can we have the patience to drag this show out, we can hit the roll, but we can also skip and drive. And that's been the secret to Denver's defense. It's not just are their rotations right. Is the recovery right? Are they keeping the ball in front? Because when you get Denver moving and you're able to beat those closeouts and now you're able to hit them in different directions, things just change. And I think the playmaking from KD and Booker has also been very good. The offense starting to open up. Little things they're doing. Hey, we're going to leave that corner empty. What are you going to do now? Hey, that corner is empty, but hey, that's Kevin Durant that's by himself on the weak side. What are you going to do? Hey, Terrence Ross, you come in the game. You start in the corner, Devin Booker's going to come off the screen. Oh, your man's starting to help? You go up to the wing. Hey, Devin Booker, you're cooking. Go one-on-one. Do you want to throw those random doubles again? Here's Kevin Durant one pass away. Hey, we'll just run double drag and see what happens. Drag it out, see how they play, as I'm sure you allude to. That makes it tricky. And that's where, if I'm Denver, we've got to get this at least to enough. Take something off the board defensively. Hey, maybe it's not KD and Devin Booker. Maybe we have no answers for the one-on-one, but hey, we can contest. Can we clean up the early help? Can we recover? Can we take those plays away? Can we get the mud adjacent? Because Denver's scoring on the other end.
Boy, are they.
I don't think Denver is looking at their offense and saying, hey, this is the issue. Can they get enough stops to make this work?
They got to be able to get stops. And to the Denver point, it's not like they haven't tried to make adjustments or tried to do different things. Like we've seen, Jokic, you're going to guard TJ Warren on this possession. We got Jamal Murray on Jock Landale on this possession, so we can turn some of this action into switches. Like they've done that. Again, the random doubles against ISO, like they've tried different things. But to your point, if Phoenix is able to ding all of that, it's so tough. And I know that's elite analysis right there. This is what you come to hear and see. It's just really tough if Denver's able to take, okay, you're not going to switch that often, but if you do, we still got a matchup we like. if you're putting two to the ball, we are spacing the floor in a way to where your helper is coming off of a shooter now. Have fun with that. And if you just don't send help and say, all right, we're just going to stay home, surely they can't score 40. Devin Booker right now is proving I will score 40. Kevin Durant is proving. Yeah, those the first two games where I couldn't knock down jumpers like that, I'm starting to find it. You have fun. On the Denver side, I guess like a very basic question here, but like Jamal Murray has largely cooked in the series. Nikola Jokic is absolutely cooked in this series. Also, brief aside, very glad he wasn't suspended. That was a very odd thing in game four. I'm glad we didn't overreact to that one. Those two have been cooking. With the others, though, it would be nice if they got a Michael Porter Jr. game at some point offensively. Like, I've largely felt fine about his defense in this series, which is going to look funny when you look at what the offensive numbers are and stuff like that. But like, largely, he's nailed his rotations. Like, I think he's been fine. They need a big Michael Porter Jr. game at some point. I don't know if that's scheming things open or just knocking down the shots that he's currently getting right now. But it'll be nice to get a game from him. Like, I think Denver does need a third at some point to really chip in and help. The offense, as you said, isn't a major problem, but it would be helpful if they got a little bit more for him to take some of the creation burden off of Jamal and Jokic. Because with the way that Coach Michael Malone has handled the rotation, like, we've seen them stagger Jokic and Murray. We've seen him sit both of those guys together. And in game four in particular, like, that felt like a gambit that was getting dinged a bit. And so if they can find some more pockets there, that could be a little bit helpful, at least get themselves set more defensively. And you can try to find some semblance of an answer against Phoenix offensively. That's just something to keep an eye on as well.
I thought MPJ had a pretty good game three. I think he's a little bit of a victim to Phoenix improving their team defense against movement. Mm-hmm. And being more physical, being more active, and throwing more switches in to take away his reads, potentially, to where it's like, hey, man, you're going to shoot. Like, we're not giving you two on the ball. You just shoot. Mm-hmm. So you're going to beat us off the bounce, or, you know, we're not going to give you the easy one. So I'm wondering, like, keeping an eye on how that works out. But it's just, it's tough when you have Jamal Murray playing like this, Jokic playing like this. You know you can go two-man game whenever you want. It's tough to resist not hitting that button. Mm-hmm.
A quick Denver defense question for you, scheme-wise. Because, like, they've, well, more than they ever have under Coach Michael Malone during the regular season, at least, they've experimented with some zone. Do you anticipate them trying that at all in game five or just moving forward? Not as a base, obviously, but do you anticipate them trying to sprinkle that in? Or do you think it's more so just going to be, we just got to play better with what we're doing right now, base-wise?
I think it's a play better button, which is always fun to talk about in the playoffs. But I think zone could be something they throw out there. I think the question is going to be, what do they feel comfortable throwing at Devin Booker now? What do they try and do to try and get him out of rhythm? Do they give him a different scheme, per chance? But that's the tricky part. Going drop sounds okay until you realize what these two have been doing over the last two games. And now you're handing them shots. I just don't know how comfortable you feel with that. So it's just going to be, can they load up? Can they get early help? Can their recovery be better? You know, is it going to be switch and double against Devin? Like, can they throw different things at him? Or is he just going to, as he advanced to where, okay, I now know what you're throwing at me and I'm making the plays quicker? Because that's been the fun of Devin Booker's growth, not just the scoring, but he's started to read defenses in a different way as opposed to predetermining what was happening or anything like that. I think the best way is to try and throw different coverages at him. I think Denver's tried to do that. He just hasn't cared these last two games.
That he has not. It's just been incredibly fun to watch. Like, I said it on Twitter after the game four. It's like, this man is on, he's on a Chelsea Gray shot making run off the bounce right now. If you remember the Chelsea Gray postseason run that just happened, where it just didn't matter what defenses threw at her. Like, to the point in the W finals, like, here's Alyssa Thomas, deal with that. And it's like, okay, here's a jumper. It's like, well, I don't know what you do, except pray that she misses. And I feel like Denver's kind of at that point was like, we just got to hope that he misses. Because again, like, there are, I guess, some more things that they can do, but it's not like they just, this is our base, he wins or he doesn't. They have done different things. They have thrown different bodies at him. They have loaded up help in different ways. They've sprung doubles. It largely just hasn't mattered. Like, the growth as a playmaker has really popped in this one. Like, the patience that he is showcasing against some of these looks. Like, it's really good stuff. Like, I remember the double team that he randomly saw gets a double drag and end up being a pass that Josh Okogie gets a layup out of it. And it's like, man, they come with a trap at darn near half court, mixing up when they send, you know, when they send the help there. And he just ducks under Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. It's like, oh, here you go. Here's the relief pass. Like, man, if he's nailing stuff like that, I don't know what you do, except hope he's only going to make 56% of his shots in game five.
The more you talk about it, it's here's the tough part. And this kind of taps into the whole we can live with this shot that likes to be talked about this time of year. If you're Denver, can we just get them to miss some of these? Can we just make it as hard as we can and get them to miss some of these? Can we take one of these things off the table? Can we make the one-on-one plays tougher? Can we make some of these pull-ups and pick and roll tougher? How do we get that? And what? How much does that help us? Like, that's the toughest part. Because Philadelphia, I mean, Phoenix has shown so much here. But now Denver, it's like, can we just take one thing off of the menu? And is that the difference for us?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just Devin Booker going 12 for 28 instead of 12 for 16? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that our wiggle room? Does that give us enough? I'm not sure. How do you feel about the KD usage, by the way?
I like the shift to using him more as a screener in game four. And like that kind of popped to some of the double drag stuff. But just in general, using him more as a screener instead of just you have the ball, ISO, or you space, help create room. Varying that and just kind of moving bodies around, I think has been helpful. How have you felt about the KD usage?
I still feel like there's more on the table. Like, I just feel like there's like they're getting better, but I feel like you can use him with the ball in his hands. You can use him off ball. You can use him as a screener. And it felt like sometimes it's like, hey, man, go score. Or, hey, man, go space. Or, hey, here's this slice to the post. And I'm like, there's more here.
It's Kevin Durant.
So, yeah, that's about it. Whose defense do you trust more right now, DeAndre Ayton's or Nikola Jokic's?
Boy, that's a free throw adjacent question right there. Wow. It might be Jokic right now. And I think that's more of a testament to Jokic just nailing what his responsibility is supposed to be. He's largely done that this postseason. Like, there were some lapses in game four, but I think that was largely about Devin Booker stringing things out and making things tough on him versus he just bottles it. So I think I trust Jokic to execute his game plan more than I trust Ayton to execute his, I guess, to answer that question. On the Ayton front, I will give him the hat tip. He played much better in game four than we've seen throughout this series. I think just the energy level in general was better. Like starting that game with, I think, what, three offensive rebounds on the first possession. It's like, okay, cool, he's here. We got the seal for him. A couple of and ones in that game four. Like it did feel like he played better defensively in game four, even though Jokic just... We spent a lot of talking about what Phoenix has done offensively, and rightfully so. Jokic just casually, what, 53 and 11 in game four? And just stare you down threes, post buckets, drives, post drives, coming off screens. He is darn near impossible to deal with.
Yeah, you got the Jokic conversation should change. Go watch the buckets that he's getting in this series. The Jokic conversation should shift a little bit. You can say whatever you want, but that has to come off the menu. I'm sorry. I'm glad you brought up that point, man. Keep going.
No, I was just going to say, like, we talk about Jokic largely because of the passing, and we know he can score. He's averaging 36.5 points in this series. What do you do with that? He's been insane. But to the Ayton point again, like I'm glad that he bounced back some in game four because, buddy, the first three games of the series for him, rightful criticism with some of the energy, some of the effort, and just some of, hey, you have to nail this coverage defensively. Or offensively, if you're going to roll hard, really force Denver's defense to bend. He did a much better job of that stuff in game four. But while we're on Phoenix centers, man, Jock Landale has brought it off the bench. It's been a long time coming back to the Jock Landale point. It was fun in the regular season. Then he largely disappeared. Bismack got in there, et cetera, et cetera. Jock been hooping. Jock has been hooping in this series. Give the man his love. He's doing what he's supposed to do. It's like, I ain't got nothing for that. You got it.
Hey, you got it, man. He's doing well. I think with Ayton, he's got to hang in there in this series. Because they need him on both ends. I thought he responded pretty well activity wise in game four, at least with the effort, but he's gonna have to hang in there. They need his roles. They need his activity defensively. It's one of those series where maybe not everything's going your way, but you got to stick with it and continue to work. It's just, it's fascinating because, you know, Denver's offense has been really, really good. Do they have a game where their offense slips? What does that look like? Is this as simple for Denver defensively as just having a little more nuance? Can you recover quicker if you're going two on the ball? Can Jokic release quicker when you're going two on the ball? Can the help be earlier? It feels like it's right on the string. It's right there. Where if Denver can figure out a few things defensively, it feels like maybe they take off. But if Phoenix has found enough offensively and they have those two, which is the reason why it's tough to deal with them, because you have to deal with Kevin Durant and Devin Booker at the same time in a playoff series. And that's not how that's supposed to work. Yeah, I should not be watching Kevin Durant dribble the ball and say, oh, yo, I need to help. Wait, where's Devin Booker?
Like, it's wild. Like, you think about this playoff run, and I think this has been overall like a very good playoff run for Kevin Durant. He has firmly been their second best player. Do you know how scary that is? He has firmly been the second best player on this team. It is wild what Devin Booker's putting together. And to your point, you still have to deal with both of them, no matter how you rank them. Denver's doing everything that they can, or mostly everything that they can. And Phoenix has largely thrown it over the top rope over the last couple of games. This has been such a fun series to track and watch the adjustments play out in real time and see, okay, how do we deal with this supernova offensive talent? How do we deal with this supernova offensive talent? It's good stuff. It's really good stuff.
The shot making is insane. Like, we can dive into schemes all we want, but with Jamal Murray, Nikola Jokic, Devin Booker, and Kevin Durant all playing at this level, I just want to sit back and I just want to watch sometimes. I don't even want to think about it. I just want to be like, wow, this is so much fun. But then, you know, we got to talk about it, so.
Yeah, well, you know, sorry to disappoint. Got to bring some structure to it. It's fine, though. It's cool. Also, just quick hat tip to the Phoenix bench in general. No Torrey Craig in game four. So we saw TJ Warren. We saw Terrence Ross. We saw Landry Shamet. 5 threes made for Landry Shamet. You'll take a game like that at home. That's going to be good stuff. We'll see how the role players continue to play as we enter the rest of the series. Lakers, Warriors. The Lakers are up 3-1. Now, again, last time we recorded, that was a Thursday morning, so it was before Game 2. The Warriors with a 27-point win in Game 2, bouncing back from that Game 1 loss. The Lakers responded with a 30-point blowout of the Warriors in Game 3. And then a close win last night, 104-101 for the Lakers in this one. I was intrigued that the Warriors once again changed the starting lineup. Gary Payton II got the start. Quick aside, I hope Gary Payton II is feeling better. I don't know what was happening during game four. It felt like he was not feeling particularly well during portions of it. I hope he's okay. But anyway, Warriors changed their starting lineup. Like, hey, we want to get a little faster. We want to improve the defense versatility, get a little bit more juice on the perimeter defensively. And largely something, as you pointed out during the watch party, like, we want to make Anthony Davis guard and pick and roll. And the Warriors largely pressed the pick and roll button in game four. I think it was 48 on-ball picks Steph Curry received. That was a series high for him. And it felt like Anthony Davis was getting dinged a little bit in the first half. I was like, huh, this is interesting. Now I remember looking at cleaning the glass during halftime. I was like, well, the Warriors have taken more shots at the rim than the Lakers have in this half. That's interesting. And then scroll down a little bit, and it's like, wait, the Warriors are shooting what percent at the rim in this half? Because a lot of it is Gary Payton II slipping by. Behind Anthony Davis, because he's playing at the level, it turns into a short roll opportunity from there. Either Gary Payton II gets a layup, or he's making the next pass to a guy that's cutting in from the corner, that's Draymond or whoever it is he's playing with. They're getting the easy ones. Like, huh, this is kind of the formula. This is interesting. But man, overall, I've just been very impressed with the Lakers defense in this series. The Warriors are continuing to tweak. How can we space the floor better? How can we use these combinations together? How can we move Anthony Davis around? How can we make LeBron work, et cetera, et cetera? But you just zoom out the totality of the series over the last three games since we last talked about this series. The defense has just been so locked. It's been so locked in. The Lakers have made some changes in their own right. They went with Austin Reeves on Steph. They went with Jared Vanderbilt on Draymond Green, tweaking that, turning that pick and roll into a switch. It's just those tweaks on top of like the top locking that they're doing to make sure that the Warriors aren't comfortable and bleeding clock in that regard. They're gapping guys that can't shoot and really mucking things up. It's just been a really impressive defensive effort for the Lakers. I think that's where I start.
with what I've seen over the last three games. Where do you land with the series right now?
Well, I mean, that's the story of the series. This is the Lakers formula. Activity defensively, let's mix in some transitions, get some guard play. Let's try and win it at the end. Mm-hmm. The Warriors have not been able to find their blend. The adjustment that the Lakers threw after Golden State said, hey, here's Jermichael Green in the starting lineup. Cool. Anthony Davis caught in those positions where he's in a drop and, oh, I have to go back to the level, open things up. Warriors found counters for the top blocks, able to get more screens in the middle of the floor, able to get more movement. They took the game plan and they countered it. But then, as you stated, when the Lakers said, all right, we're not doing that again, all this Steph Draymond stuff's going to be a switch. Jermichael Green, we're not guarding him. So Gary Payton II, one, I think it was for defense. My mind went to offense, but I think it was for defense to try and get some more switchability. Two, he did do what he was supposed to do in the short role. Anthony Davis did have to guard someone. Like, hey, if we can't get the Draymond stuff, we'll just have Gary Payton do it. And they dinged the Lakers' weak side help defense. The problem is the Warriors cannot hit the blend right now. You mentioned the numbers pick and roll heavy. They tapped the pick and roll button a lot. Did it change how the Lakers guarded? Did it alter anything? So now you combine the fact that they have to smash this pick and roll button. The movement has been lost. The flow has been lost. The Lakers are still physical off ball. So you're seeing these possessions where if it's not pick and roll, it's pass, cut, shot. And that's not the Warriors' game.
It's not. And then even to the pick and roll point, it's nice that Steph ran a lot more and the Warriors, again, they were able to get some good stuff out of it. How about the other end? And something that you pointed out during the watch party is like, huh, the Lakers are putting Steph in action quite a bit. I looked it up this morning between Steph guarding whoever the ball handler is or guarding the screener and getting called up in the action that way. He defended 32 picks in Game 4. And the Lakers got good stuff out of that. And I think 32 was the series high for him. They're making him work too. And I think that kind of bleeds into as the series goes on, or I guess with a 3-1 lead, we don't know how much longer it's going to go on if the Warriors aren't able to find answers. But as the series goes on, you think about the workload Steph has offensively. You think about the physicality that the Lakers are playing with, the different matchups that they're throwing at them to take away those openings. And then on the other end, you're fighting over this screen. You're fighting over this handoff. This guy's calling me up. It was a show and recover. Now Steph is just switching on some of these. And that's where you got a lot of the LeBron post-ups against Steph in Game 4. That's a lot of burden. And I think that's where it really hurts that the motion stuff isn't working. Because now, you know, Steph is Steph. He can get his with the motion or without it. That's what makes him great. But I think the theory behind the motion with Steph is, one, it's difficult to guard, but two, we get Klay in the rhythm now because he's getting easy stuff. We get Jordan Poole in the rhythm now because he's getting easy stuff. We get a couple easy ones for Draymond. We get some easy ones for Kevon Looney. And now everyone feels good with the ball in their hands. If you remove the motion and now it's just Steph creating pick and roll, that can work because Steph is one of the greatest players of all time. But it works for Steph. How much rhythm was Klay in last night? How much rhythm has Klay been in this series largely?
I made 14 threes the first two games.
Yeah. So it's like, what? So that's a good point on Klay. But like, I guess with everyone else, it's like, okay, where's the consistency? Like for me, it's turned into, okay, what are the Warriors getting out of their guards, not named Steph, in this series? And I think you had just the guards period as an X factor, but I would assume that kind of leaned towards the Lakers side. It felt more like, okay, which guards are going to play and which guards are going to play well? Did we see Jordan Poole in the second half of Game 4? It's just kind of tough. Klay didn't have it going. They got Moses Moody back in there. And again, I applaud the work that he's been able to do. But the fact that they are now having to lean on him to this degree feels like an issue based on how the Lakers are still guarding him. To your point, how much have the Warriors tweaks changed the way the Lakers want to defend? It hasn't felt like a ton in terms of who's gapping where and stuff like that. They'll flip around who's guarding who so they can turn some stuff into twisters or whatever. But largely, do we think he can shoot? Eh, we're peeling in to help. Do we think he can shoot? Eh, it's a short close. Now it's not going to be driving, kicking, getting us in rotation. Now you got to beat us. I think it's mostly been masterful stuff for the Lakers on that front. And man, just again, going back to the defense point, what Anthony Davis has done in this postseason has just been wild. The offensive production has fluctuated. We see a 30 here, 14 here, whatever the case may be. The defense has been locked in. He has taken so many things away. Either with blocks, deflections, or just his presence alone turns some of these drives, which what could be a layup turns into, oh, this is a tough loader. Or let me dribble out here. Let's swing it. Let's get something else. It's been a really good postseason for Anthony Davis. I just wanted to give him his flowers. Question for you, Steve. How have you felt about LeBron?
I felt good about LeBron. I think he's had an understanding of the moment in this series. He may not have as many drives, but you know he's trying to be a pressure point, trying to force help. I think his work attacking Steph Curry, both with the ball in his hands and as a screener, has been good. I think the defense has been really good. The end of the game, the Warriors go to that hammer play. LeBron calls out every switch. They get a stop. So I think he's done a really good job. We should appreciate what he does.
All right, I got you. Do you foresee any more lineup tweaks from the Warriors moving forward in the series? Or is this just going, or have they just reached the play better, nail our game plan portion of the program?
No, I mean, this was the question I had going in. Do the Warriors have the lineups they need? And I don't know where else you go outside of Jordan Poole. There's what other combinations are you going to hit? Anthony Davis likes the Kevon Looney matchup. If you're small, is Draymond being guarded by Anthony Davis to really open him up on the offensive end? Jordan Poole played 30 minutes in game one, right? Shot 7 of 15 from the floor, 6 of 11 from three. In the three games since, he's played 48 minutes, shot 5 for 19 from the field, hasn't made a three. Dante DiVincenzo is 5 for 18 from three in this series. The best wing guard is Moses Moody right now. So the versatility is just not there. They're not shifting what the Lakers are doing. And the other thing is, like, they have to sustain. I think that's the missing part. The Warriors, despite all this, have had opportunities. But they're not humming offensively. They don't have drive and kick and movement and pick and roll. Defensively, they're trying to keep up with their guards and pick and roll, but the pressure points are getting them. It's been a game of runs, Nikias.
Boy,
game three, the Warriors are up 40-29 with 7:53 left in the second quarter. They're down 40-42 with 4:43 left in that same second quarter. They're down 42-51 with 2:23 left in that second quarter. Game four, the Warriors are up 57-49 with 10:35 left in the third quarter. They are down 57-59 with 8:58 left in that third quarter. The Warriors are up 68-59 with 7 left in that third quarter. They're down 84-86 with 9 left in the fourth. The chances have been there. They have not been able to hit their finishing move. And you can't let this Laker team hang around. And that's where you get big performances from Austin Reeves. That's where you get big performances from Lonnie Walker. Think about Lonnie Walker, man.
I'm so happy for him, man.
Since 1997, you know the Lakers that have scored 15 plus in the fourth quarter?
Go ahead.
Kobe, Shaq, LeBron, Powell, and Lonnie Walker the fourth.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's a huge part of the playoffs. You have your game plan. You've set your budget. So when something happens, we can't deal with that.
I thought his expense.
Yeah, his ability to score one-on-one, his ability to, okay, I can take Steph Curry one-on-one if the play breaks down. I can make these shots. I can do this. That was big. It just feels like can the Warriors get out of the mud series? And they haven't been able to. And the Lakers only got to keep them there one more time.
Mm-hmm.
One more game of defense. You've tried to get 80 up to the level. Can you hit that pressure point? Can you get your flow going? If you can't, the Lakers are going to grind their way to the conference finals. Because for the Lakers, it really is, hey, let's just get it close going into the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Now everything we do makes a lot more sense. Now, Steph, you got to come here, buddy. Although it was very interesting, though. That fourth quarter, it was like a little weird for a second because they were attacking Steph Curry in pick and roll. And then you realized, oh, Lonnie Walker has it going. But then you realize, oh, Anthony Davis hasn't touched the ball in like 5 minutes. Which direction are we going to go? And for a second, they just stopped putting Steph Curry in pick and roll. And I was like,
I don't know if you want to do that. It's working. Hey, come on. But then Lonnie Walker, he's just cooking. It's like,
Yeah. And then I got to give a salute to Anthony Davis. I think his work against Kevon Looney has been good. I think when Golden State's tried to double, he's been patient, spun away from doubles, saw help, attacked after cuts. It's been good stuff. I'm not going to do the, is he going to do the thing? No, that's not me.
he's doing what's been asked of him, which is anchor the defense and then please go and please score. Like, that's the order. And I think that would help some of the, I guess, some of the angst with like some of the Anthony Davis box scores. If you think about it in that way, he's asked to anchor this defense first and then produce when given the ball. He has passed the first one with flying colors, and he's had enough big offensive games to where we shouldn't be having to, like, do you want Anthony Davis to have a 14-point game? No. But he's done his job defensively. And the blueprint for the Lakers starts with, we are bringing you to the muck. And you do that by stifling the half-court offense. And that has largely been done because of the presence and the activity of Anthony Davis. Give him his flowers for what he's doing right now on the defensive end.
And mixing in some switches against Steph Curry. Now, I don't know how much you want to do that, because afterwards it's like, oh, Anthony Davis is now on the perimeter. But being able to stay in front, being able to contest, I think it helps going in the fourth. So we'll see if the Lakers can get one more.
That we will. Last series to touch on, the Miami Heat up 3-1 in this series. A blowout win over the weekend, a 106-85 victory in game three. And then last night, a 109-101 victory over the Knicks in this series. And I think for me, it's just kind of funny. Like, I was going back to what I said before the series, and I landed on Heat in seven, but I didn't feel good about it, I think was my exact wording in that one. And I was just like, ah, Jimmy Butler isn't going to see the same openings. The help is going to be a little bit more aggressive. Bam's still going to have to solve the size thing. The Knicks really beat you up on the glass, etc. The Knicks have this really good bench. And then you zoom out through four games of this series. Steve, do you know what the bench advantage is in this series right now? Just in terms of bench points?
Nope. Tell me, though.
116-62. Miami's bench has outscored New York's bench by 54 points in this series. New York, who is one of the best offensive rebounding teams in the league this season, they have one more offensive rebound than the Miami Heat in this season. The New York Knicks, who were a top five offense this year because they didn't turn the ball over and they got a bunch of extra opportunities. Again, offense rebound battle is basically a wash. The Knicks have turned the ball over 11 more times than Miami. The Heat are out-nicking the Knicks right now in critical areas. They have battled on the glass. They have won the bench. They have won the possession battle. Miami is shooting 31% from three in this series. And it hasn't mattered because they've taken more shots. They've had more possessions. I've just been very impressed with how Miami's gone about their business. The help, again, you think about how the Knicks defend. Like, we're going to peel in this help. We're going to force tough decisions. We're going to be active. Miami's like, bet. We're going to do that more aggressively. RJ Barrett, I do not care where you are spaced. Josh Hart, I do not care where you are spaced. We got some Deuce McBride minutes last night because Emmanuel Quigley was out. We do not care where you are spaced. Julius Randle, we care a little bit, but not too much. Jalen Brunson, you're going to see length early in the series. You got Jimmy Butler, Simons, also Caleb Martin. Now we're going to go with Gabe Vincent. He's going to pester you. We're going to have a whole bunch of help peeled in behind that. You have fun. Jalen Brunson had himself one heck of a night. 30-10, or whatever it was. How many easy buckets did Jalen Brunson have in game four? Maybe two? Three? Like, Miami has successfully brought this thing in the mud. They've won in the little areas. I think that's what kind of stands out to me right now as we kind of zoom out in this series. Where do you land with this Heat Knicks series right now?
I mean, it's been a developing story in this series. When game two happened, no Jimmy Butler, Miami's able to generate shots. Should have told you something. Game three, Miami doesn't really play well offensively. Blowout win. Should have told you something. The big thing for me, it's been the Heat's ball movement against the Knicks' help defense and rotations. The Knicks have not been able to load up in the same fashion that they did in the Cavs series. Miami has continued to play outside of the play. They keep the Knicks' defense moving. They're hitting random cuts. They're getting multiple actions. They're getting a driving kick. And it's getting better as the series goes on. And if Miami is going to be able to continue to generate these kind of looks, put this kind of pressure on the New York Knicks defense, it makes it tough to come back. Because this isn't all just Jimmy Butler doing things in this series.
Mm-hmm.
There are times where they will try and double Jimmy, and that also opens things up, which is a tricky balance for the Knicks to hang on to. But I think it's a different challenge. Mitchell Robinson, you can see the impact he had in the Cavs series. It's not the same. Bam is either space at the elbow and diving or flashing into open gaps. Or Mitchell Robinson is having to go from help, pick and roll coverage, back to help. And it's just a lot of work. Watch these games and look at how the Knicks are having to rotate. Look at how much the Knicks are having to work. And look at the type of shots that Miami's able to generate. And then on the flip side, the Heat have really put in the work to give multiple efforts, to keep that ball in front, to rotate and recover. Really good team defense. The Knicks' best stuff has come when they're able to loosen Miami's help. The problem is it hasn't been very often. You mentioned that Jalen Brunson's having to work. It's not just the ball pressure all the way up the court. They're denying him if he doesn't bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
If he gets a catch, go back and watch and see the amount of bodies that Miami is throwing at him. See the space that he does not see. They're working to take away space, working away to take his comfort. Think about the comfort that he had in the playoffs against Cleveland. Counter that with Miami. Not just the personnel. Hey, you want to go to the Max Strus matchup? Here's a flat show or a drop. You want to attack Kevin Love? Here's a flat show or a hard show. Either way, it's not going to be a switch.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get Duncan Robinson? He may trap you. He may foul you. But you're not going to be able to hit that button. Bam is stuck with his drop. So he doesn't have that same rhythm, that same flow. When the Knicks make quick decisions, good things happen. But how much have they been able to pay, make the Heat pay? Nikias, game two was their best game, right? 16 to 40 from three. Game one, the Knicks 7 of 34 from three. Game three, 8 for 40. Game four, 9 for 28. I'm not a great math wizard. That's 23.5% from three. I don't want to go all Stephen A, but huh? So you got Jalen Brunson for getting all this help. You got Julius Randle, who, by the way, I think has done a good job with his drives, but he has to be so on point with getting the right matchup, attacking, getting to the basket, making shots. Like, it's a very specific blend that he has to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to get those two going while no one else is making these shots.
Except that's for RJ, tough. Who the Heat are fine with that. Okay, good job. Hey, 24 points and hey, good job. L.
It's there's things they can hit, but I don't know if it changes Miami's overall concept. And that's where my concern is. If you can't change how Miami is guarding you, and Miami's also able to generate looks, and they also have Jimmy Butler, and Bam's getting more comfortable in the series, and the Heat bench is staying aggressive, it becomes a tough formula. Like, I can talk about the Knicks. Jalen Brunson could screen for Julius Randle. That's cool. Jalen Brunson could screen for RJ Barrett. That's great. You can get Randle the matchup against Max Strus. You can go empty corner pick and roll. You can get Randle one pass away. All these things we've talked about. Has it changed what Miami is doing?
No. And, like, just quickly to that point before I hand it back to you, like, I remember seeing the starting lineup change. Like, okay, cool. Quinn Grimes is in here. He's a good shooter. He defended Jimmy Butler more than anyone during the regular season series. Neaton, I asked you before the watch party. Hey, Steve, how do you feel about the Quentin Crime start? How do you think that's going to change what Miami does? Like, it doesn't. Like, oh. In my mind, I was like, well, I mean, he can shoot. You know, he's a better spacer than Josh Hart. Like, he might be able to make it a little bit deep. And sure enough, like, within the first two possessions for New York, I want to say Quentin Grimes in that same left corner. Max Strus guarding him. Try to get something going with Jalen Brunson. And there's Max Strus peeled right in. I was like, well, Steve's got it. You know, this is why, you know.
And I'm not writing off the Knicks. Don't get me wrong, but they have to do these specific things to win this. Jalen Brunson has to have a big night. Julius Randle has a big night. But how much of those are tough shots? How much of those are going to be shots that Miami can live with? So you're going to need that shot making. You're going to need to be able to make quick decisions and beat Miami's help. And then defensively, you're going to have to tighten things up. Now, if they can do that, there's still some wiggle room here. Because even with the Knicks outside of game three, that game four wasn't the best offensive performance. They were able to fight and scratch and claw their way back in. They just couldn't get rebounds in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, was it a 6-0 offensive rebound edge for Miami in that quarter? At least at one point of the fourth, it was that. I was like, yo, okay.
So now they've got to fight their way out of a hole, one step at a time. One thing I do want to point out, I want to give a salute to Jimmy Butler's defense. I feel like Miami has really done a great job secretly of moving him all over the chessboard. Like, hey, here's, you guard Jalen Brunson. You can also guard RJ Barrett. Also Josh Hart. Also Julius Randle. Also Mitchell Robinson. And the way that I like to think of it is like, cool, you guys have kind of found something. Let's just throw Jimmy in the mix to kind of bother it a little bit. Like, you want to do the wing actions where, like, you have one wing screen for Jalen Brunson, like Josh Hart, and then here comes RJ Barrett. Well, that second screen's now a switch. Good luck. Enjoy. Oh, okay, you found a thing where, like, we defend the first part of the set, and then you find Julius Randle. Well, now Jimmy Butler's on Julius Randle, and we're still helping, so good luck. Oh, you feel good about Mitchell Robinson screening? Well, Jimmy Butler's on Mitchell Robinson now, so he could switch. It might just be a drop, but good luck. We're just going to make you think about it.
And, like, that one's extra funny, because Miami went smaller. I want to say Jimmy was out there, Bam was out there. I think Caleb Martin, Max Strus, and Gabe, or it was either Gabe Vincent or Kyle Lowry was out there right now. So, like, okay, cool, we got Jimmy at the four, kind of. Bam's on Julius Randle. I was like, okay, that makes it. Wait a minute. Who's on Mitchell Robinson? And it's Jimmy Butler. And I was like, let's see if it works. And sure enough, just continues to muck things up. It's so funny. Like, Jimmy hasn't been Buck series wild. He's still averaging 27, 7, and 6. Knocking down over half of his twos, getting to the line roughly 10 times a game. Like, it's just, it's like, yeah, he does see more help. No, he's not as ridiculous. No, he's not knocking down those threes. He's still really good. He still gets to dictate a lot of what you do defensively. And also what he's doing defensively, as you just pointed out, is insane. Couple quick hat tips for me before we move off of this one, kind of close things out. I talked about it earlier in the series, but the work that Bam is doing in this series has been so important. Bam in a drop, helping box out Mitchell Robinson so other guys can get rebounds, they can push in transition. As you touched on, Bam getting more comfortable offensively. Like, that flash to the middle, pump fake against Mitchell Robinson, the dunk that came in the first half. I was like, wait a minute. This is decisive, Bam. He's reading the floor well, knowing where the help is, where the pocket is. He gets the catch. He immediately goes. It's not a catch, hold, survey. Hey, where's this next guy flowing to a handoff? This is my time. This is my opportunity. I'm going to snatch it and go. Seeing more of those has been a lot of fun. Not just boxing out and allowing Miami to clear in defense positions. What he's doing on the offensive glass in this one has been very important. And when he spaced, something that you've also touched on, but when he spaced out in the perimeter, Mitchell Robinson has to play a little bit higher because they know if this ball swings the Bam, we are going right into a handoff or a pick and roll. And that's just complicating things for Mitchell Robinson. The way that Bam's been moved around the chessboard on both ends of the floor has been really fun. It's been very important. Like, no, we haven't seen the 35-point game from Bam yet, but he's been really darn good in this series. And to the bench point, I highlighted the bench points difference, which is way more start than I anticipated. This is arguably the most aggressive stretch of Kyle Lowry's season so far in terms of the pull-up. He's taking that gap. He's doing what needs to be done there. Defensively, he's fighting. If he switched on to Julius Randle, he's getting his hands in there. He's drawing some charges. He's being annoying, generally. Fighting defensively, making the right plays. He's pushing the tempo after defensive rebounds, getting Miami into early offense. He's nailing it. Caleb Martin, the way that he's attacking gaps for Miami, because he is a help point for New York. Like, okay, we don't trust that he's going to shoot. He's chewing up that space very quickly when the ball swings to him. The screening, something I talked about earlier during the regular season, because I didn't feel like he was a very good on or off ball screener. The screening has improved for him, and that's mattered in terms of Miami's flow. They can just go to different things early in the clock, or if things break down, you got to go to second or third action. He'll just flow into a screen and dive and then relocate from there. It's been good stuff. Very impressive effort for the Miami Heat in the series.
I like that you, just to add into your tip of the hat, it's the automatics with this Miami team and how locked in they've been with those this whole playoffs. Milwaukee series, drop, we can get to our pull-ups. This series, we know the ball is going to skip and move. We can get to not just a shot, but we can drive, get the driving kick, be ready to let it fly, still mix in some pull-ups. They've been locked in there, and they need that, especially with Hero.
Mm-hmm. It's been really impressive stuff. All right, Steve, before we go, do you have free throws?
I have a couple for you, man.
Okay.
Power rank these stomps. Draymond, Joel Embiid, Seth Rollins.
Oh, my God. If you would have threw Kurt Franklin in there, I really would have lost my mind. Oh, geez. Well, I will say, we're going to go Seth Rollins 1, Draymond 2, Embiid 3. There you go. At least, you know, he fallen back. It wasn't in, I don't want to use the I word, but yeah, that was a little bit different than the other two. I'll put it that way.
Gotcha. Strong or dislike? Karl Anthony Towns for the nickname Big Purr, or you for the middle seat?
It's me for the middle seat for sure. But man, if you have not heard the podcast with Karl Anthony Towns and Paul George, please listen to it. The video is also just great because Karl just deadpans. Now they call me Big Purr. What is that? He did not say what is that. Listen to the real version. But he was so he's like, oh, you think that's funny? Oh man, that was good stuff.
Nikola Jokic said when he got to the league, he was watching Tristan Thompson, LaMarcus Aldridge, and Boris Diaw. Your thoughts?
One of those makes sense.
LaMarcus, got it. All right, final one for you here, Nikias. Should the Heat have taken Bam Adebayo when they had Epke Udo at home?
Can I just say, like...
Nope, we don't have time. No,
yes, we do. We gonna get to 30 seconds or less on this one. On Twitter, you know, you get takes out, and people can cold take you, and that's fine. Like, that's just part of the game. If you end up wrong on something, people can fire up. All I ask when it comes to the Bam Udo tweet is that you understand the context of that tweet. Like, still flame me, because it ended up working out. Bam became one of the best players in the league, etc. But my point was not about Bam specifically and thinking he was bad at the time of the draft. The point was, Miami had just given a max to Hassan Whiteside, and they had a lottery pick after a weird season, and they used it on another center that wasn't projected to be able to play next to Hassan. So my point was, why are you allocating draft resources or a lottery resource to a center when you're just investing in a center? And if you were going to invest in what was projected to be a backup center, and Bam came off the bench his first year and a half, sign Ekpe to do screen roll defense and get him for the minimum versus using the lottery pick. That was my point. It could have been anyone drafted in that spot if they were a center. It's not about Bam. So I just want to clarify that. Still flame if you want, but that's the context.
Hey, that explanation is great, but you still want to pick up your bag of baggage claim because they are packing you up.
That is A-okay. And with that, thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can follow me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter. We are having fun discussions in there. If you have not already, join us for the Dunker Spot online watch parties. We're watching these playoff games live. We're having a lot of fun doing that live analysis. Now with the screen share feature, we're able to pull up clips and, you know, we have our own little halftime show or between commercial breaks, we're breaking down plays that happen. Having a lot of fun. So if you want to have some fun with us, learn a little bit, come rock with us there. I believe this episode will be on YouTube, so subscribe to JJ Redick's YouTube channel to catch our content and obviously catch his and everything that he's doing there. And with that, we will catch y'all later in the week.
Bye.